Welcome to the Rewrite Your Life Story podcast, hosted by your favorite duo, Stephen and Charlene. They're here to help you transform your mindset and create a positive outlook on life. Are you tired of feeling stuck and unfulfilled? Are you ready to take control of your thoughts and emotions and rewrite your story? Well, you're in the right place. They will be sharing inspiring stories, practical tips, and expert advice to help you on your journey to a better you. You'll learn how to let go of negative self-talk, embrace your strengths, and focus on the good things in life. Each episode, we'll be joined by amazing guests who have rewritten their own life stories and are now living their best lives. From successful entrepreneurs to accomplished athletes, we'll bring you stories of resilience, courage, and triumph. So grab a cup of coffee, get cozy, and get ready to be inspired. Tune in every week for a new episode of the Rewrite Your Life Story podcast. Let's rewrite our stories together and make every day count.
In this episode, we interview Bob DePasquale. He is a purpose-driven impact maker and believes that everyone has the ability to make a positive impact in our world. When Bob was 18, he moved to New York for college. While in football training camp and just 5 days before September 11, 2001, he was diagnosed with cancer. Join us as we delve into his story.
Before we get started, we want to remind you that the information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and their guests are their own and do not represent the views of any organisation or entity. Additionally, any information presented should not be taken as legal, medical, or financial advice. Always consult with a licensed professional in the respective field for any advice or guidance. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's dive into today's topic and learn how to transform our lives through positive thinking and taking control of our stories. Thanks for joining us.
Before we begin, we want to give you a heads up. We may be discussing some sensitive and personal topics that might bring up some strong emotions or discomfort. Our goal is to create a safe and supportive space, but we know that everyone's experiences and triggers are different. If you start feeling overwhelmed or triggered during an episode, remember to prioritize your well-being. It's totally okay to hit pause and take a breath. Your self-care is important, and looking after your mental and emotional health should always come first. If you ever need extra support, we encourage you to reach out to a mental health professional or someone you trust. You're not alone, and there are resources available to help you on your personal journey. Thank you for joining us on this incredible ride with the Rewrite Your Life Story podcast. Together, we'll navigate life's challenges and rewrite our narratives with strength and resilience.
Hey everyone, it's Stephen and Charlene from Rewrite Your Life Story, and today we're super excited. We've got Bob DePasquale,
Yes. Also
known as the Generosity Guy from Initiate Impact, all the way from Fort Lauderdale in Florida. Bob, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me. I am pumped to talk to you guys. You know, I love talking about people's personal stories and asking questions, and I get the chance to maybe share a little bit about my own today. So it's going to be a pleasure.
Awesome. Now, Bob, you've got such an amazing story that's really written your destiny and written your life story. From a really young age when you moved to go to college in New York. So Bob, why don't you just take us a little bit about your background before moving to college and the impact that that had on you?
For sure. I was actually born in New York, where my dad and my mom's side of the family, they're all from up there. And I moved to Florida when I was three. My parents kind of did it backwards. I mean, some people will retire down to the southern part of the country for better weather and, I guess, more pretty surroundings. And my parents actually chased my grandparents down here. When my dad's parents moved down to Florida, they came down to visit and they found that they loved it so much. I was just 3 years old. My parents were young and they said, you know what, we're getting out of New York. Other than my dad's parents, we're going to be the first people to really leave the nest, if you will. And they came down to Florida. I grew up down here in subtropical weather, just beautiful, just a great place to grow up. It was not that as populated as it is now. We moved to a small town west of Fort Lauderdale that wasn't even a town. It wasn't even a city yet when we moved out in the 80s. And it was just beautiful out here. And it's hot for a lot of people, but I grew up where it was warm and humid. And I loved it. We were playing sports outside. I spent most of my life outside. I just really enjoyed growing up. I was an only child, so I was a spoiled brat, mama's boy. if you really want to know. And it was a nice time. I loved it all the way up through middle school, high school. Anything was fine. I had just about everything I needed. My parents weren't independently wealthy, you know, by any means. They worked really, really hard. They were both employees. They worked in supermarkets and in banks. And my dad took a job in a health food store after his supermarket that he worked in when he got a job down here. And so I just learned hard work. I learned how to support. My parents were always generous people. Now, interestingly enough, I never really identified how generous they were. It was just kind of part of how we were. I mean, my parents were just giving people. I remember going to my dad's 50th birthday party when I must have been a sophomore. I mean, I could do the math, but I was a young high school student. And I remember going there and there were so many people at this party that I had no idea who they were. And the majority of them came up to me and a lot of them said, you know, I love your dad's a nice guy. He's good at this. He's good at that. They were very nice people. But the one thing that stuck out to me is they always said that he was such a giving person of his time with people. And I just thought that was really interesting. And so looking back now, I think that kind of shaped a little bit of my mindset. But you mentioned before I went to college. And so that was in high school. And eventually I was graduating high school and I had a chance to go to college. And it's a tough decision for young people, even back then. And I ended up having an opportunity to go back to New York to go up there. I was going to play American football. And I was going to get an education and I was going to spend a lot more time with family that was up there that I didn't really get to see, but maybe once a year. So that was my upbringing up until college. And, you know, I have to be pretty positive about it. It was a great experience.
Awesome. So you're in college. What happens next?
Wow. So this is really kind of the critical point of my life. I think it's critical for a lot of people as you're growing up and having a chance to become an adult. But mine was kind of a unique experience. So I went up to college actually about a month or so early. So over here in the States, I mentioned American football. I have to say American football because it's not footy, although it's a cool sport. I've seen it on television before. I've never had a chance to play that. But training camp is about a month long in college before the season starts. And the season usually starts right around the time school starts. So we're up there a month early before classes even begin. So my college experience initially was not like a typical college student. I went up there and basically living in, you know, it was like going to football camp and playing and practicing your sport. And my thought was, man, I got to go up here. I'm a freshman. I got to prove myself to my teammates, my new coaches and everything. And the first couple of days of training camp were tremendous. I mean, I felt like I was playing pretty good. And I ended up coming up though with a pulled groin muscle. Now, first of all, I thought I was invincible. I thought I was this 18-year-old kid. Nothing can go wrong. You guys feel that way when you're 18? You felt like you're just like this invincible person and nothing's ever going to go wrong. Well, that was me. And then I pulled a groin muscle. And then pretty quickly, I was like, wow, that's one of the most debilitating, painful muscles to pull. I don't know about you, but I couldn't stand it. Really, I couldn't sit or twist or bend over. You don't realize how much you use your groin muscle. You know what I mean? And so I was doing these rehab exercises. And a college training environment, I mean, there's doctors and there's multiple trainers. It's not like high school where there's one or two people maybe and a bunch of student volunteers. I mean, it's a pretty sophisticated operation they have to get their athletes who they're paying their education. They spend a lot of money on this, so they want to make sure that their athletes are healthy. So one of the exercises I would do is I would sit on this three-wheeled stool and I would shimmy like sitting on the stool across the training room. Now, like I said, there's on a given training camp morning at like 5:30, 6 o'clock a.m., there's probably 100 people trying to get stuff done in this room. So part of the exercise, I think, was just dodging these people. And I think it was supposed to strengthen the muscles in my abdomen, my hips by doing this. I was doing that for like a week and I wasn't getting any better. And I'm thinking to myself, what a stupid exercise. Like, what a waste of my time. And people are looking at me like, you know, what are you doing? I was like, I'm just doing what the trainer is telling me to do. So our head trainer, his name was Rick. Now, I'm not going to exaggerate anything in the story except for maybe this next moment. He was a small guy. He's maybe 5'6" or so, you know, 140 pounds soaking wet. But he would have to stand on this box to get people's attention because it was so loud in that room. There's so many things going on. And I remember one day he stands up and he cups his hands and he yells across the room. Now, it was usually so loud, I felt like it got dead silent at that moment. And I don't know if it did, but to me, I mean, I heard him loud and clear. He screams with his hands cupped. He's like, Bobby, they called me Bobby back then. You got to get back out on the field, quit being a weakling. And I thought to myself, man, this is this little head trainer guy calling me out in front of my teammates and my coaches and all these people that I'm supposed to be proving myself to. I felt like such a loser, to be honest with you. And I said to myself, something's wrong. Like, I'm not getting any better. This can't be right. So I actually had a more private meeting with the guy later. I said, Rick, listen, man, first of all, I don't appreciate you calling me out in front of everyone, but something's not right. This is not getting any better. You got to give me something else to do rather than this silly exercise. So he's like, yeah, you're right. I'm going to send you to a doctor. So he sends me to a urologist, and I had all these appointments over a series of the next week or so. Just about every day, I was driving all across Long Island, New York there by myself. Now, technically, I'm an adult. So I'm 18 years old. In the States, technically, I'm an adult. But I mean, I'm a kid in my mind, right? But mindset, I'm totally a young person. And I'm driving around to these appointments, and I would get into these appointments, and they would ask me questions about medical insurance and health history and all these things that I have no clue. I'm like, just give me the test. Like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I'd be there for hours filling out paperwork and then waiting and then preparation and then the test. I had ultrasounds, CAT scans, sonograms, MRIs, you name it, every test in the book they were giving me to try to figure out what was wrong. So eventually, I had an appointment. I'll never forget this. It was on a Thursday. And my parents were coming up for my first ever college game. Now, we knew at this point that I wasn't going to be playing in this game, but my parents were coming up anyway. And they're like, well, we're still going to come. And they would be staying at my uncle's house, which my mom's brother who lives up there. And so I'll never forget that I went into this appointment. I expected to be there for hours, like all the other appointments that I had been to, countless ones over the past week and a half or so. And so I get into the reception area and I walk up and I sign the thing and I go sit down. I'm expecting to just kind of sit around. Now, cell phones and like electronic stuff wasn't as fancy as it used to be. So it was kind of boring sitting in these offices waiting. Remember when you used to read a magazine in the reception area of a doctor's office? Now everyone's sitting on their phones and playing, but I remember sitting there. But this time, within about 30 seconds, they call me. I mean, I sat down and 30 seconds later, Robert DePasquale, and they call me. So they take me back to the room. I sit down in this office and another 30 seconds goes by and the doctor walks right in. I mean, everything was so fast. It was like a blur. And he sits down in front of me and he looks me in the eye and says, Bobby, you have cancer. My jaw hit the desk. I didn't even know how to react. And I'm dead silent. And he says, don't worry. We're going to hook you up with an oncologist and then we'll figure out a plan. You're free to go. That was his words. You're free to go. And I thought to myself, I'm free to go. I don't even know what an oncologist is. And you're just going to kick me out here? Like, give me some more information. Well, ultimately, I ended up leaving. And this is the kicker. When I walked out of this building, and I had never been here in my life, but I don't know where I am, but I walk out of the building. And the moment, like right as I was walking out of the building, it was like divine timing. My phone rings and it was my mom. I pick up the phone and she goes, oh, hey, I wasn't expecting to catch you. I thought you'd be in the appointment, but I was going to leave a voicemail since, you know, text messaging wasn't popular back then, right? So she was just going to leave me a voicemail. And she goes, but while I have you on the phone, how'd the appointment go? And I was like, yeah, mom, about that appointment. And so I had to tell her what the doctor said. And I tell you, Stephen, Shirley, I mean, I can't even explain the dead silence on the other side of the phone, but I heard or felt my mom screaming. I can't even explain it. And the only thing I remember hearing when I told my mom that, on the other end of the line, my dad was also in the car that they were in on the way to my uncle's house. And I heard him yelling, Susan, what's wrong? And I just couldn't believe the discomfort that my dad felt. He hadn't even actually heard technically what was going on with me. And so we ended up meeting back at my uncle's house, and I had never been alone away from home for that long. So I gave my parents a big hug and we kind of shed some tears. We said some prayers and we were just kind of in shock. And so that was a Thursday. So now a couple of days went by and it was the Saturday, which was the day of the game that I was not playing in. So we were actually at my uncle's house and my uncle's best friend came over. Now, we don't know this guy because he's from New York, and we never, you know, we lived in Florida for all those years. And his name was Tim, and he came over to the house. I never forget, we're standing, my uncle has a kind of open area in the kitchen, and we're standing there, and he walks in, and he says hi to my aunt and uncle, and he introduces himself to us, and he walks over to my parents, like I just met them, walks directly over to my parents, and he puts his hands in his pocket, and he pulls out his keys. And it looked like he shoved him in my parents' face. I don't think it was like that, but that's the feeling he got. And he's like, Bob, Susan, take my car and use it for whatever you need. I can't imagine what you're going through with your son right now. And my parents were just flabbergasted. They were like, wait, what? And they ended up taking the keys. And I thought to myself, I was like, wow, that's the most generous thing that someone's ever done for me and my family. And we thanked Tim. I mean, it must have been awkward. And then he just said goodbye to my aunt and uncle. And that was it. I mean, he was at the house for maybe 15 minutes. And then he left, gave my parents his car and left. And we were like, that was crazy. So Tim was obviously a generous guy. And I was like, I could not believe that he did this for us. So that was on Saturday. Then a few days later, I had already spoken earlier, I think it was Friday, that we spoke with the oncologist. And he told me to don't drop out of your classes because we want you to stay in New York so you can treat your cancer. So that Monday was my first ever college class. And I went to my first ever college class, used Tim's car to go to some doctor's appointments. I mean, it was like, I don't want to say a normal day, but it was what I felt like was going to be a normal day for me over the next couple months, year of my life. Well, the second ever college class was on Tuesday morning. And I go into this class, get the syllabus, you know, whatever it was. I'm thinking, okay, I'm learning to be a college student. I come out and I go to the cafeteria to grab something to eat. And I remember watching, there was a TV, got 8-inch bracket tube television hanging from the wall and the ceiling on a bracket. And the news is on. I'm 18. I'm not really into watching the news. I don't even know the news station because I'm not from New York or I didn't live in New York. But the news is on and I'm watching. And all of a sudden, a plane hits a building in Manhattan. And I'm thinking, wow, what a terrible accident. And I actually called my dad and I said, hey, daddy, are you watching the news? Are you seeing what's going on in New York there? And he's like, yeah, that's really sad. So we're talking for a minute. And then all of a sudden, bam, another plane flies into another tower. And we didn't know at the moment, but that was the September 11th terrorist attacks were happening right there. And we're like, this is a crazy, I mean, something's wrong. Something's really wrong. And my dad's like, you better get back in the car and hightail it back to your uncle's house. So I was eating like a breakfast burrito or something. Man, I dropped that thing so fast. It's probably still sitting there in the cafeteria 20 something years later. I hopped in the car. I was going to get home. Now, typically it's a 15-minute ride from my school to my uncle's house. Well, people were panicking. Things were going on. It was crazy. It actually took me 9 hours to make this drive. Now, subsequently, since after that season of my life, I actually have a master's degree in broadcast journalism, and I worked in radio for a couple of years in AM radio. I actually enjoy listening to the radio, but not 9 straight hours. I will never listen to 9 straight hours of AM radio again. And I listened to the whole report the whole day with burning towers in the distance, trying to get out and crazy traffic on the highway. And believe it or not, I got off the highway and I ran out of gas in my uncle's neighborhood. I can only imagine if I would have ran out of gas on the highway that day, it would have been nuts. But I ran out of gas in my uncle's neighborhood and we ended up having to push my car into his driveway. And we pushed the car into the driveway to get out. And I look at my mom and my dad and I'm thinking like, this is nuts. Just a few days ago, I was invincible 18-year-old Bobby. Now I was questioning my own life because of my diagnosis. And now we thought maybe the world's coming to an end. And it was just a hysterical day and few hours. Now I tell you this story because my uncle, who was on business that night before, was stuck in Denver. And at the time, we didn't know where these planes had come from. And we were kind of worried that he was in one of those planes and we couldn't get a hold of him because the cell phones were out, communication was hard. Well, finally that evening, maybe it was 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, I don't quite remember the exact time, but he calls and he told my aunt, hey, you know, I'm okay. I'm sorry. I got stuck in Denver. I've been trying to get a hold of you guys, but the cell phones have been out, but I'm okay. And we're like, oh, thank God. And right before he hung up though, he's like, but just so you know, I need to let you guys know, Tim, my friend who came over on Saturday, well, unfortunately, he was in one of the towers this morning and he died. And we looked at each other and we're like, that's impossible. Like, here's the guy who did the most generous thing ever for our family. Like, he just did not deserve to die like that. What a terrible way. And so it turns out that Tim was a super generous guy and he worked for an organization investment firm called Cantor Fitzgerald. If you're in that industry, which I happen to be now, they're a pretty familiar organization, but their CEO, Howard Lutnick, there's a YouTube video. I'm sure you can go out and see it if you search for his interview after 9/11. Now, he was the only one, and he was not typically out of the office those mornings, but he was taking his kid to school or something silly, not silly, but something that he didn't normally do. He was one of the people running on the street away from that. He survived. Hundreds of people from Cantor Fitzgerald died that morning. in the thing. And his survivor's guilt, you can just tell, is terrible. And so finally, I tell you all of this because Howard was the only one to survive for Cantor Fitzgerald. They were such a generous organization. They would donate office space to my uncle's foundation for cystic fibrosis, which is a disease my cousin has. But they would just give this office space to the foundation. Now, the only person that was typically in the office that early for the foundation was the lady by the name of Tammy. So everyone else was safe. No one else was there. Tammy was caught in the subway below the towers that morning. She did survive. But the stories that she can tell about escaping that, the attacks, are just incredible. And so I always think Tammy was spared. But why was Tim and his other colleagues, why did they have to perish that morning? And it turns out that Tim truly was a generous person. Obviously, I spent more time researching and talking to him and his family since then, and my uncle, my aunt. But you know how people say, talk about FOMO or fear of missing out or you only live once, those things? I'm okay with them. But in a lot of cases, I think they're selfish. Tim would say, you never know when your last opportunity to be generous to someone would be. And it turns out that my family was his last opportunity to be generous, and he capitalized. And so generosity in my life has really become something because of those period of time in my life.
As you can tell, I am crying with your story. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
You got me talking about your mother, and that Tim's just put me over. That's a lot for an 18-year-old. I'm sitting here as a 40-year-old listening to you and cannot, like, obviously, we're talking 20 years ago, so cancer, you've survived that, and we can talk about that later and that, what was that? But I'm struggling processing this as a 40-year-old, like someone in my 40s, as an 18-year-old draw strength to do this.
That's an interesting question, and I'll tell you, I still struggle to process it as a 40-year-old myself now. But I've had practice, and I've been doing it for 22 years now. And so it's a journey. You know, I think a lot of the things that you talk about on your show is people's experiences that have built a mindset for them. And so that is certainly a critical point in my life. But because of that event, I now have a different perspective on other experiences in my life, even some of those that happened before then. As I mentioned with my dad's birthday party, it given me a different perspective on other things. So did I process all of that in that moment? Absolutely not. In fact, I think the mind shuts down. I know there's psychological studies on this. I also know that different people have different ways of handling stress. But for me, I'm kind of a nose down, put the blinders on type of guy. And my oncologist and my family and the people of my loved ones in my life really encouraged me just to concentrate specifically on what I could do to get healthy and work through those things. So it really was put the blinders on, concentrate on making sure that I was alive and figuring, doing exactly what people told me to do. And so it was a bit of a blur for the next 6 months or so, because it was just get treatment. And we can talk more about my cancer treatment, but ultimately, I mean, your question or your commentary was about processing it. And so mentally, if physically, it took me technically 6 months to do treatments and work through those things. And then mentally, it probably took me a year just to kind of get back into like college 18-year-old mindset on like what was really important in life. But if I'm being completely honest, it took me probably 2 years to get through the emotions of it all and talk to different people about it and learn how to actually express. I mean, I can talk about it now because I've been doing it for so many years, but it took me a while to actually express what happened to me then. And then since that 2 year period, I remember having a conversation about 2 years after that. But since that period of time, and even before that, but literally, this is not, and I said, the only thing I would exaggerate was how quiet it was in that room when Rick called me out in front of my new teammates. Nothing else I will exaggerate. And I literally think about that period of time in my life every day. And I don't mean this deeply, and I'm not in a contemplative fashion, but at least for a short moment on some days and longer on others, like today, I think about that time in my life. So I truly believe that it's taken me 22 years now to really process it. And I will continue to process it and think about different things in different ways. I mean, I had a conversation with my cousin. I mentioned my cousin who has cystic fibrosis, and you know, thank God he's doing much better now, and the foundation has really helped in research and learning more about that disease. But I had a conversation with him not too long ago about his experience during that period of time. He's about 10 years younger than me, so he was, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9 years old while I was 18. And the stress that he was going through, because he was at the peak of his struggle with his disease at that time. And he was reminiscing with me about how at 8 years old or whatever, he was close to it, he noticed that our parents were finding ways to get us to spend time together because they knew we were both really, really struggling physically, that we needed some kind of relief. And our bond is so close now. And I remember I didn't spend any time with him because I lived in Florida, but that 3, 4, 5 month period that we were kind of suffering together really, really built our relationship. And so these type of things, you just don't know. And not a day goes by where I don't think about that period of time in my life. And I'm constantly learning lessons. So there are some days where it's hard, especially around September 11th. What are we recording this on, the 28th of September? So a couple of weeks ago, it was tough for me. I mean, that time can be very, very challenging as the reminder for me and my family. So to answer your question, there is no perfect way to process it. I think the most important thing is time and being able to have different experiences that help you do so.
It sounds a little bit like that whole nose down, blinkers on. It was a bit of a saving grace for you to be able to get through that in the meantime. I'm not sure if that's something you would agree with.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. And I still have that characteristic in my life. There's some things that other stressful things in my life. I mean, I'll be fully transparent. Yesterday, so it's in the morning here in the States. Yesterday was one of the hardest days that my wife and I have ever had together because we had to put our cat to sleep. The poor guy had developed lymphoma and things. And so this is the perfect example of me. I'm a sad person right now for the loss of my pet, but I am committed to spreading the word of generosity. So here I am on the podcast, loving talking to you guys. And that's my style. I didn't realize it at the time, but yes, it absolutely helped me. I would warn people though, because I think sometimes it can be an unhealthy practice if you don't have people in your life around you that enable you to take a break. I mean, my thought was at that time, I'm going to go through cancer treatments. I'm still going to practice sports. I'm going to take classes. I'm going to do everything, all the things, and you get wiped. I mean, you have to take the mental and physical break. And so it's good to have the blinders on, but it can be challenging to stop yourself because I think there's a little bit of a fear, whether you realize it or not, that the reality is insurmountable. So the thought is, well, if I just put the blinders on, I don't have to think about that. And it kind of eliminates that fear, but you'll collapse if you don't take care of yourself. So I would warn people, but yes, I do agree what you're saying, Charlie. I mean, I certainly, that helped me at the time because the doctor told me that the type of cancer that I have is extremely aggressive. And I didn't actually mention it, but if maybe you could have figured out, it had started as testicular cancer. That's why I had the groin issues and something going on down there. It ended up spreading into my abdomen. And so the doctor said, wow, this is a really aggressive form of what you have. Now he said, it's very, very curable. So I feel like your life can be spared, but we got to get going like right now. And so it was kind of jarring. I thought I was going to be the best cancer patient in the world. I mean, he told me exactly what to eat, what not to eat, when to eat, how much to sleep, how to spend my time. I had like a log and I would do everything at exactly the right time. It was almost even more stressful to follow such a regimen. I give him credit and I give my family and my friends credit for helping me stick with it, but that's what I had to do. I absolutely had to stick blinders on, not think about anything else and just get healthy.
Bob, I want to ask you a personal question and please feel free not to answer it if it's too personal, but during this time, did you ever question whether you would survive this?
This is a hard one because people have asked me this one before. We're absolutely willing to answer. I don't know how well I can though. My thought was when he told me it was really aggressive yet very curable, I think my thought was I'm going to survive this. I had no question that I wouldn't because I had that mindset that we just talked about. However, after I mentioned some of the emotional stresses that I had after that all happened, my mortality was a lot more evident in that 6 to 12 month range. And then beyond after that all happened, I realized what happened. And I had for 10 years, I had to go back to the doctor and get tests. And there were some nerves when I would get CAT scans and other things. So interestingly enough, when I actually had the cancer before it went away, I was nervous. And it wasn't until 10 years later. So it was September of 2011. My wife and I are married at this point. We didn't know each other when that was going on. Technically didn't know each other. And I sat down. I think she maybe went with me to a couple appointments, because at that point it was once a year. And she went with me to this one. And it was the first time that my doctor ever sat me down and looked me in the eye. And it was almost as jarring as when the other doctor told me that I have cancer 10 years before that. He looked me in the eye and says, "You're cured." And I'll never forget, like, I was living my life for the past 10 years, so it wasn't debilitating. I mean, I was an adult and doing fine, but the relief that was off my shoulders at that point when he said, "You're cured," after 10 years was really, really powerful. So to answer your question, it was such a relief after 10 years being cured, but I was more stressed and more worried about beating it the farther away I got from the diagnosis and the treatment. And it's strange, but while it was actually happening, I was pretty confident. Maybe naive, but I was confident.
Yeah, it's almost like this shadow on the back of your mind, and it's not there, but yet it's always there until you get that final or clear. Bob, thank you so much for sharing. Yeah, there's so much richness in your story and so much strength and resilience. I want to go back to Tim. Obviously, Tim was a pivotal person and somewhat of a mentor, even though you only met him for 15 minutes and you got to meet his family. And now your whole story is about generosity. I've got so many questions around Tim and how it's propelled your future. My first question was, you did mention passing that you got to meet some of his family.
Yeah. So he had three kids, very, very young at the time. But his wife was good friends with that, because him and his wife were good friends with my aunt and uncle. And so I spent a lot of time over the next few years, like, meeting her and getting to know her and talking a little bit about Tim. But I was still pretty young. You know, I didn't ask her too many questions. And as I got older, I got a little bit more curious and I would talk to my aunt and uncle. There's a pivotal moment about related to this, though. Both of my cousins are married now. Both of the kids, one female and one male. So I mentioned my one cousin who has cystic fibrosis. His sister got married probably 5 years. Time flies. Well, at that wedding was the first time that I really got to connect with the kids as adults now, because you're talking to, you know, almost 20 years later. Now they're young adults. So that was kind of a cool experience to talk to their kids a little bit and say, "Hey, you know, your dad, I knew him for 15 minutes, but he was the most generous guy I've ever met." It wasn't the deepest conversation because, I mean, we're at a wedding and a reception and there's a lot going on, but I really had a chance to thank them and explain to them what that meant. And so it was really nice to be able to do that. They asked me a few questions and it was a really beautiful experience. And it was one of those things, it was kind of a microcosm of the whole experience myself. Like I said, I couldn't process it all in the moment and I had to wait until after. So I remember having that conversation and thinking, oh, that felt really good. It was cool to meet them. And I told my wife, and I think my wife was there with me because we were walking around. That was late at night. It wasn't until the following day, I remember when I woke up, that I actually had a chance to process that conversation. I said, wow, you know, that was really meaningful that I just got to speak with them, because their father meant so much to me. And I'm sure they've heard stories about their dad because they were so young, you know, just toddlers, if not younger, when he passed. So yeah, I did talk with them and it was really, really meaningful.
So moving forward, 20 years have passed and your message and your purpose now and your mission is what I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, twofold. One is helping families get their finances in order so that it can meet the second prong, which is around generosity and being able to be more generous. Let's speak about the generosity part first.
You did a great job explaining it, by the way.
Okay, great. So let's talk about the generous part. And obviously, generosity had such an impact in your life. But what made you decide that this was your purpose in life, preaching or spreading the word around generosity?
I alluded to my graduate school training in broadcasting. I thought if I wasn't going to be playing sports when I was an adult, I'd be talking about it. So that was my goal originally in life, or thought that that's what I would do. I love broadcasting. I love communication. I have no problem being in front of a camera, behind the mic. Like, I love that stuff. And so I did that for a couple of years, but I got recruited into the financial industry. And it's kind of interesting. It's a long story about how I got recruited. I no inkling, no desire to be in that industry when I was younger. But I ended up going, and the main reason why I made the decision after putting off this recruiter for 6 months plus is that there were some questionable money practices going on at the radio conglomerate I was working for. And I thought to myself, this is not super generous. And I don't even know if I thought specifically the word generous at the time, but I just felt like that they weren't treating their customers and advertisers well. And so the recruiter, I don't think he had any idea on how to recruit me. But that moment in my mind, when I had a couple days off during the holiday season, which was rare working in sports radio, that I thought to myself, this is what I thought. Now, I was naive, still young kid, not 18 anymore. I mean, I was young adult, but I thought, I'm going to go into the belly of the beast. If people in the radio industry have questionable money practices, I'm going to go directly into the financial industry, and I'm going to teach people how to be wiser with their money and more generous and more giving. That was just my mindset. I don't know what I was thinking, but maybe that was the blinders on mentality. I was going to put my nose to the grindstone and just work. So I did that, but to my pleasant surprise, I thought I was going to find a bunch of cutthroat people who are all money hungry and selfish, whatever, greedy. That's what I was feeling. But to my pleasant surprise, I found that a lot of people, in fact, the majority of people out there, are naturally generous, caring, giving people. Like, they just want to support their family and the other people around them in their communities. Like, I was pleasantly surprised. However, there was one problem. A lot of the messages that they got from their other people in their lives or their jobs, you know, the professionals, the environments that they were in, were telling them that they weren't capable of doing that. And they desire to be compassionate, but they weren't good enough to be able to be compassionate. And to me, it was just terribly saddening over the years. So I spent 12 years working for a large financial organization, and they taught me everything about the industry. I love them. I cannot say enough about how I learned how to be a good financial professional, how to learn. And I was just so happy that there were people who cared and were compassionate. So that kind of changed my mission right there. And I realized, though, that the problem was a lot of the messages in the world, whether it was in their professional lives or just on social media, different places, were telling them that they don't have the means or they're not capable of living out their compassionate mindset and the desire to be generous. And it was just so saddening to me that all these people were sitting here, hey, we want to care for others, but we can't. We want to be generous, but I don't have the time. I don't have the money. I have to work. I got to take care of my family. I have too many things going on, or I need to read another self-help book because I need more self-care. I need to improve my skills, or I need a tip, a trick, a hack. And it was just really frustrating and saddening to me. And so my business partner, who was my colleague at the time, we had no desire to leave our employer. We loved working for them. We learned just about everything about the industry. I'm forever grateful to that organization for teaching me the ropes and how it works, and how to have really deep money conversations with people that can be very, very challenging and emotional. But we ended up leaving because people were asking us to do some things that we just couldn't do in that business model for compliance and regulatory reasons. I was so thankful, and I still am to this day, for my former employer for kind of helping me work through what it's like. I mean, it was a challenging career, especially for the first 6 years or so. And so I got to a point where people were asking us to do some things that we just couldn't do in that model. And I tried, and I asked them, and I said, a lot of the things that you're teaching me, I'm trying to help people with myself. But it just wasn't possible legally. And so we said, you know what, it's time. And we made a really, really tough decision to leave. And so because we wanted to not only focus on the technical aspects of financial management and taxes and different legal things that we were helping people with, which is important, don't get me wrong. I mean, people need to do things correctly. And so we have technical expertise there. But I think the real thing that we like to concentrate on is helping families build out a mission and a desire to be generous amongst their family and in their business too. You know, a lot of times people will come to us and say, hey, you know, we've had a lot of success in business by whatever definition that is. And now we want the bottom line of our business isn't as important as it used to be. It's still important. We still want to grow, but we also want to help others do the same. And so helping transfer that legacy in their business and in their family to that next generation so that they continue to be good stewards of the resources is really important. And so that's what we focus on. We're a wealth management firm, but we're really champions of generosity. And it's not just money. It's with time and talents and other things as well. And so we find that the families and the businesses that are the most giving with the resources that they have are the ones that grow the most and the ones that have the deepest relationships. And so we found that to be incredibly fulfilling work. And over the years, you learn how to help people navigate that road because it can be challenging. It's not easy. Don't get me wrong. I've never said being generous is the easiest thing in the world. In fact, it's very challenging at times. But I'd be curious to know your all's thoughts on this. But I think the biggest challenges in our life are the ones that we find the most growth from. Yeah. And so when a family comes to us and says, we want to be incredibly generous towards this cause. We want to volunteer. We want to travel. We want to help. We want to give money. We have resources in our business that we can lend to this cause to make the world better for somebody else. We find the ones that are willing to take on those challenges are the ones that find the most fulfillment and make the biggest impact. So it's tough. So really what we're doing is we're really helping people take on some really, really big challenges that they care about. It's fun work. It can get a little stressful, but it's really, really fulfilling. And so generosity is very, very important to me professionally because of that. And then personally, because of what we've already discussed.
Awesome. You talk about radical generosity, and I want to explore that a bit more with you, what your definition of radical generosity is. But I also want your view of, do you see generosity as philanthropy? Do you see it as something spiritual? Do you see it as something that everyone can participate in? And when we talk about, like, I'm loading you with three questions in one here. When we talk about generosity, is it financial? You said it's money and time, but what are some of the causes that you tend to, or your clients come to you with to say, you know, I want to be generous? Do you help them find the cause, or do you have a network of causes that you work with, or is it whatever they want to do?
I love that question, because as we grow in our business, that's only 2.5 years old now, what better time to start a business than during a pandemic? And so to answer your question in short, it's up to the people. But I think that part of our expertise and network is also very, very helpful, because it can get confusing. It can get overwhelming. I mean, there are lots of options these days. Thankfully, technology is great. I mean, look, we're on the other side of the world. We're talking to each other, which is tremendous. That means that in a lot of the things that we do in our lives, whether professional or in the impact space or personal life, like, we can do things and connect with people across the world. So it can be challenging. So our network of existing organizations and our understanding of how those systems work is really, really helpful for people to narrow down their choices. However, we don't say, here's a list of 10, pick one. It's what's most important to them. And we've had people come to us with the first conversation we had. We thought, man, that's a really, really unique cause. How are we going to help them do that? Well, part of our job is to do the research. Part of our job is to reach out, and we want to do that. There's a lot of people in our industry, and I hesitate to be critical because this is not something that's required or not something that I think every wealth management firm needs to focus on. This is not my plea, but a lot of them do not do the research. They'll say, sure, we would love to help you with this. Let us know the cause, and then we'll facilitate the financial gift, or we will make sure that you get the tax deduction. You know, we'll make sure the CPA writes it off on your taxes. And so that's not the only thing that we do. We do all of those things because those are important. Why would you not do it the way you're supposed to? Or why would you not take advantage of the benefits that the government's offering you, at least in our country? I know when we work with international families as well, every country's got different rules. And so it can get complicated. But overwhelmingly, that's not the driving force and motivation ultimately for multi-generational giving in a family. Is not just, I want to make sure that I save on my tax return. They'd be foolish not to. And so we do that. But the families that we're working with want to make sure that the next generation has the same desire to give. Now, it doesn't actually be the exact same causes. It's not from on high. You must give to what we give for our family the rest of our life, and you have to do exactly how we do it. In fact, this next generation, and you can look at, there's books, I've had people on podcasts. There's a lot of resources about how the next generation has a different way of giving. And so much of our work is to help facilitate the transfer of the values, not necessarily the methods or the places that resources are given to. So to answer your question, yes, a lot of our work is in that space, and we do more than just facilitate. For example, I'll use an example from my life, like childhood cancer, for example, is a popular cause. There's plenty of causes that you can give financially. It's very easy. Giving is almost too easy these days. Now, I have some strong opinions on this, and this is a whole nother tangent, but you can go online and within 30 seconds, you can give money to a cause. It's very, very easy, which is good for the speed of the transaction. But as a family that said, we don't want to just give to the cause. Like, we want to give financially if they need financial help, but we want to assist. We want to go there. We want to support. We want to get our hands dirty. And so we found other organizations that allow you to do that, to travel and to go places, to sit on boards. Maybe they don't want to travel, but they just want to be on a Zoom meeting like this. And so that to us is just as important, because the data shows the organizations that you participate in are the ones that you're going to support the most. So if you're a fundraiser out there or you're someone who's in the nonprofit space, you know this. If you have someone who just cuts a check for some money and you never see them, that's great. You get the gift, but you're not likely to get another gift from them. But if you bring someone into the facility and they help participate in the cause, you're much more likely to get recurring gifts, and then they'll continue to support you. So we find that that to be incredibly, incredibly important to families, that they get involved. And the benefits of giving, I share all the time, are not just about, there's three parties involved in a gift. It's not just the receiver.
You spoke about being good stewards a moment ago. You just grazed over that. Speak into that for me.
Well, stewardship is one of our core values for my family and for the people and for our business, because I believe that managing your resources is one of the most critical things to doing well with what you have. I think because there's so many distractions and things in this world that will tell us, I kind of alluded to it earlier in the professional space, like there's so many things that are telling us that we need this, we need more of that. And the fact is, just about everything out there, someone needs, but not everyone. And so being a good steward of your resources is critical, because you can easily use them. There's so many causes and ideas and things out there. So when I hear the word stewardship, I think it's critical to just about every area of life. So in my professional life, I got to make sure I'm a good steward of the resources that my company has so that we're doing the best for our customers. Our customers have to be a good steward of the resources that they have so that they can live out the mission that we're helping them develop. My family has to be a good use of the resources that we have so that we can live and survive. I'm in a couple organizations involved in a couple that have specific causes that of my own impact that I really, really care about. I provide advice and I sit on boards and I help them steward the resources that they have so that they can advance their own mission. So I think in just about every area of life, it's critical. I mean, if you think about it, if you go into your pantry or your kitchen in your house, right? This is the way I look at it. There's umpteen variety of foods and snacks and things that you have in your closet there in your kitchen. Well, you're not going to boil the steak and grill the beans. You have to figure out how to use these resources correctly and maximize, because they're not worth as much as they are if you don't use them properly. And so that's why stewardship is so important to me. I think that it's too easy. I mean, you know, one of the worst things in the world, I think, is the one-click buy on Amazon. How many times can you go on there and scroll and be like, oh, that looks cool? In less than 30 seconds, you can buy something, which is cool for convenience. But I think we would behoove a lot of us to spend a little bit more time thinking about how we're using and stewarding our resources.
Absolutely.
So powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm going to throw a bit of a curveball here. There's certain schools of thoughts and certain different philosophies that money flows and it's a resource, it's an energy. Where your attention goes, there your money goes as well. And to someone that's actually not got the right heart intention and is giving to receive, rather than giving for the cause, not expecting anything in return, what would you say to that person?
Well, I think reciprocation for a gift is something that I think we've all experienced before. So I would say to that person or anyone considering that, first of all, it's totally natural to have a feeling that, okay, there's some expectation. I think the difference, though, is what you're truly looking for. Because if you're expecting a gift in return, is it by definition truly a gift? Or is it just bartering or trade? And there's nothing wrong with trade. I mean, listen, I'm in business. So I know that I'm trading services for financial gain. I mean, I would be foolish to say that that's not the case. But the question is, what are the things in my life that I expect something in return, but it's not directly for remuneration for services, or it's the gain is more emotional or for a bond, or it's a sharing. I was on a trip this summer, an incredible, like once in a lifetime type of trip thing that my wife and I and a bunch of people that went on. And the gentleman was talking about, I love to talk about generosity and giving. And he had no intention. He didn't know this. He didn't know anything about this. A large group of people. I just happened to be in the audience. And he talked about sharing. And it hit me in that moment when he was talking about humans, because I believe humans have a desire to give, which he didn't disprove. But I think he also proved to me that humans have a desire to share. And so the reason why I bring this up related to your question is, I think the healthy relationship with giving relates to sharing. And so what I mean by that is, when I'm giving someone whether it's financial or it is, maybe it's a helping hand or something, it's not with an expectation that I directly get an object or some kind of payment back from them. Like I said, that's businesses or trading, but it's the expectation that I get some kind of bonding feeling from them. And you can do research on the hormone oxytocin. I mentioned a friend of mine, Wendy Steele, her TED Talk. I mention this often. She did this TED Talk probably 10, 12 years ago now. And she talks about oxytocin and how there's three parties, which I also alluded to earlier in a gift. And so it's absolutely okay, in my opinion, for someone who expects to have some kind of bond or some kind of mutual understanding or some kind of fulfillment from giving. That honestly should be expected. In fact, if you don't receive those things from giving, I hate to say it, but you're probably giving wrong. You're probably not doing it right, or you're giving to the wrong cause, or the gift isn't as helpful as you think it is. And which is another strand that we can talk about, is about how I said generosity is challenging, because I think there are times that we can give incorrectly. So my point is, I would say to that person, you should be expecting emotional return, and you should be expecting the feeling that you're helping this person and that you're sharing in doing a project. And there's nothing more powerful than that. One of the best experiences, I've had multiple experiences. I'm involved. There's an organization in the world called Habitat for Humanity. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but I've had the incredible pleasure of taking multiple trips to different places and helping families build homes. And the interesting about this experience is that, first of all, I am the worst in construction. I mean, I can barely use a hammer or a screwdriver. Like, you don't want me coming over your house fixing anything. But these experiences, helping families build homes, doing something hard with someone else is, and overcoming it for a third party, is like one of the most powerful things in the world. And I say this because the second, third, fourth time I went on these trips with Habitat, the first time I didn't know what to expect. I just went thinking, okay, what an honor that I got asked to go on this trip. I won an award at the previous employer about it. I was the divisional volunteer of the year. And I don't want to toot my own horn here. In order to explain the story, I have to explain how I got on this trip. It wasn't like I was researching it. They sent me. They said, okay, we're going to send you and a representative from each region across the country. And I went in just saying, you know what? I'm going to go do this. I'm not into construction, but it's an honor to win this award. I don't know what I can even add to the cause. They're not going to want me helping build anything, but whatever, I'll just go. And I went in with no expectations. The following times that I've gone, I'd be lying if I told you I didn't expect to get something back from it. I absolutely did. But my expectation was not to go and they were going to pay me to build their house, or they were going to give me some kind of gift. And they always give a gift, usually. And I didn't matter what the tangible gift that they gave me was. The expectation that I got was that I would get to know a family deeply, intimately, and help them with what that was going on. So what I got back from that was way, way deeper than anything I could ever dreamed of. And I think it's absolutely okay to have that expectation. In fact, I think if you don't have that expectation, you may not be truly committed to that cause. So this is a really long-winded answer to your question, Stephen, but I think it's okay to have expectation. It's just a matter of what you're expecting.
Love it. Thank you so much.
And on that note, Bob, like, I know that a lot of people out there like have this maybe mentality that if I give, maybe there won't be enough for me and my family. We out of pocket ourselves, or out of, mm-hmm. you know, too much time outside and not enough to my family. What kind of things would you say to them?
Well, I encourage families to do giving together. Giving is great on its own, but it's exponentially powerful when you do it with multiple people. I'm sure if I would have safely and been able to navigate the whole trip by myself when I went on my first ever Habitat for Humanity build across to another country, sure, I probably would have had a great time with the people and learned and would have been awesome. But the fact that I did it with 30 other people that I didn't know was tremendous. So I always encourage families, at the youngest you can, that's, you know, safe, obviously, whatever it is, whether it's going to a local food bank or cleaning up the beach, or one of the most powerful things that I've ever experienced was multi-generational communication in this space, right? So having a young person, whether it's phone calls or even asking, like if you've ever seen a young person ask an older person what they need or what they need help with, it's one of the most heartwarming things in the world. And so I always tell people, get them involved. So if you're going to do, like, if there's a cause that's really important to you and your family, why not get your kids to participate in that? Have them go with you to the place that you have to go to, or have them write letters that you have to write to communicate with people who are in need, or have them ask questions. I've seen great uses of technology to do this. Now I had so here's an example. I mentioned my wife was leaving for Orlando this morning, and she just got in the car with some friends of ours. Well, this time last year, this same trip, same conference that they're going to, our friends who just picked her up, the wife, she got really, really ill. And I'm sure it's okay with them for me sharing this, but sadly, she's been ill for a while now, dealing with the issues and everything that happened. And so there was a period of time where she was in the hospital, and the family, and they have two girls and the husband, and they were really struggling because mom was in the hospital and they were driving back and forth every day. It was a really, really challenging time for them. Someone had the idea. I don't want to take, it's not my idea, so I'm not going to take credit for it, but we're going to bring them food because dad was driving back and forth to the hospital. The girls were trying to go to school and do their homework and sports practice. And it was a really, really stressful time for them. So we went over there and we brought them food once. And someone said to me once, or sent me a text message and said, hey, you know, we should probably see what they need. And I said, well, I just left there. We brought them food. We had dinner with them. I'm like, oh, it's really nice. Do you think they need more food? And I was like, I would imagine. I mean, she's in the hospital. What are we going to do? So this person called someone else up and they created this online spreadsheet. You know, you got to love technology. And so basically they created a sign-up list, and we got this family within like less than a week. We had 3 months worth of people sign up to bring them food. And some people did like Uber Eats type of thing. We'll just order it and have it delivered. But some people would go over with their whole family, get their kids involved, and the whole family would cook a meal and bring it over to the house and sit with them and have dinner for an hour, hour and a half or whatever. And the stories and the power of that, those relationships that they built there was so much. So if someone wants to get people involved, there's nothing better than actually doing something. Because think about it, the family where the person was at work and they just said, you know what, let me go online, order them some food, have it delivered. Sure, I'm sure they were absolutely eternally grateful for getting the free food. But think about the escape, per se, that they got for an hour and a half of the family that actually cooked a meal. Even if they didn't even cook it, even if they just went to the supermarket and bought it, but they actually went over there and had that period of time. And young people are so impressionable. So I bet you that they've learned lessons from that. My first thing is get involved. Everyone in the family, even if it's a baby, just bring them along, get them involved. It's so, so important because you learn to experience those emotions of the human connection, which I think we're missing. I mean, I don't know about your guys' thoughts on this, but I think a lot of times we're missing that these days because we don't have the opportunity to meet with people in person.
That's really beautiful, Bob. And it's really something that's very touching. And we can see that sense of community that we build in different families. Just to finish off with this, Bob, if you could go back and rewrite your life story now, what would that look like?
I knew this question was coming. it's so powerful to think about this. Rewriting to me has a very, very meaningful purpose in my life because I had an opportunity to write a book and I realized the best advice that I got when writing this book. Now, my thought was, okay, I'm leaving my firm. I wasn't really allowed to do media and write. I couldn't write a book. I had this freedom. And I thought, man, I got so many ideas in this crazy head of mine. I'm going to write this book. I'm going to dump out all my knowledge because I'm so smart, right, on this book. Millions of people are going to buy my book and they're going to learn from all my ideas. And it turns out it's not what you know when you're writing a book, even if it's on a podcast. And you guys are a great example of this. I'm sure you're very wise people and you probably had some amazing conversations and could educate people tremendously. But the questions you ask are so powerful. And so curiosity is really what it is. Not what you know, it's what you want to know. So when you talk about rewriting a life story, when I wrote my book, I had to have editors and people help me and all that. And by the time we were done with the book, it was less than 5% what I knew before I started writing the book. And it was 95% of the things that I learned along the way. And so with that being said, writing my life story, if I was going to do that, I'm not one for many regrets and many things. I wouldn't wish what happened to me back when I was 18 on anyone. And I'm not the type of person either who says, well, I'm not just okay just saying it happened to me and move on. I think about this a lot. And so rewriting my life story to me is not necessarily changing the things that I didn't like or eliminating the pain. Like I said, we had to poor Kobe, our cat, who we loved for many years, is no longer with us after yesterday. That was a really sad day. I can easily say I would never want to go through that again. Let me just eliminate that day in my life. However, my perspective is a little bit different. it's not about eliminating. It's about being more present and understanding those moments sooner and quicker. And as I get older, I feel like I've learned to do that. So if I was going to rewrite my story, I think I would just be more intentional about understanding the lessons that I'm learning in the moment. And then I think that enabled me to maybe share those lessons a little bit sooner and better for people. That doesn't mean I regret the way I've done it, but I'm always looking for improvement in that area, because I think that part of the compassion and generosity that all of us have that I mentioned earlier or multiple times on the show, I think is our desire to share. And here comes the word share again, to share what we know and what we have. And so if I have all these opportunities in my life, especially over the past 22 years since I was a cancer patient and I saw the 9/11 experience, I know that I have a lot of things that I've seen and felt and understood. So my desire, natural human desire, is to share those lessons with other people. So the better I can do that, whether that's rewriting what I've done or moving forward, I want to be able to do that. So your question is very deep. And I would encourage people, whether you're on a podcast or not, to consider that question more often in life and just, you know, put things down. Like, we're so busy. There's so many things going on. Take some time in your life to just eliminate distractions and consider the scripts in your life that you would rewrite.
Bob, thank you so much for your time. And if you want to know more about Bob and his work, please go to his links on the socials in the show notes. And also there'll be a link to his website where you can find more about Bob and what he does. Bob, thank you for being so honest and truthful with your story. Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely welcome. I appreciate your questions. All the best with what you all are doing and the knowledge that you're bringing in, but also pushing out. Your curiosity is contagious. Thank you.
Now that we've interviewed our guest, join Charlene and I as we recap today's episode. Well, Charlene, it's not often that I quite on an episode. Definitely today is the first time I've cried on an episode of Rewrite Your Life Story. So to all those listening, I'm sorry for being a little bit of a blubbering mess. However,
that's your vulnerability.
Yeah, however, that the whole thing when he spoke about his mother and Tim, look, I'm going to start again. Like, it just is amazing. The guy that he met for 15 minutes, who was tragically taken just days after, had such an impact. And I guess the unspoken lesson here is you never know what impact you're going to have for someone in their life.
And it's like they said, like that whole mentality that he had, you never know when the last opportunity is to be able to be generous and to be able to give out.
Yeah, I think Bob's doing this awesome. In so many areas where he spoke about generosity as well, like, generosity can be financial, it can be time, it can be just sharing random acts of kindness. It's not what it is, but it's just living that life of generosity with no expectation.
Absolutely. And it sounds like, I consider there's that big difference between just giving and actual that spirit of generosity. Because when you give me out of that, like without expecting anything material in return, and just looking for that bond and that connection.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful part.
Because what he did say, if you get involved, people that get involved in organizations tend to be lifetime givers or give multiple times once they're involved. And that reminds me, like on episode 2, we had Angela from Mercy International. And because we've met her in person, there's that bond to give more to Mercy International. And it just rang so true. If you haven't listened to episode 2, that is an amazing story of how Angela went to Thailand to work in an orphanage.
Check it out.
Yeah, check it out. She's been there. But it just made that true. And then I know people that also have gone to Thailand for a few weeks with Angela and that bond there. So that just really made sense to me and built that connection around episode 2 as well. So again, thank you, Bob. And please check out his work, check out what he does. It's truly amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to our podcast today. We hope you found it informative and inspiring. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and share it with your friends and family. Also, make sure to visit our website at www.rewriteyourlifestory.com.au to learn more about our mission, products, and services. And remember, you have the power to rewrite your own life story. So go out there, face your challenges head on, and create the life you've always wanted. We'll see you in the next episode.